Thank you. Good morning, Jamarl Thomas. It's Ted Rall. And of course, you're watching Deprogram with Ted Rall and Jamarl Thomas. It is Tuesday, April 28th, 2026. Thanks for tuning in, liking, following, and sharing the show. How are you doing this morning, JT?
What's going on, man? Doing okay this morning?
So far, so good. So kind of an interesting, quirky show we have today. We'll be talking about the low-cost airlines like Spirit Airlines shaking down you, the federal taxpayer, for the $2 billion that they don't want to give you for your health care. Also, the news out of Mali. I know you're interested in this, JT. Yes. We have the whole story. It involves Russia, France, Mali, the U.S., Al-Qaeda. It's got everything. And then a story that's near and dear to me, which is Gulnara Karimova. I don't know if – are you familiar with her at all? So she's quite a piece of work, as they say. She's the daughter of the late Uzbek president, Islam Karimov. And he was a spectacularly unpopular despot who used to boil his political opponents to death in a giant vat of water. I have the photos. The daughter, and as well as the rest of the family, was looting Uzbekistan for years. Anyway, she's now on trial in absentia in a Swiss court for basically this crazy money laundering and theft operation. Unfortunately, she can't attend in person because she's already in a gulag in Uzbekistan. So it's all good times. So anyway, we are here 9 a.m. Eastern time, Monday through Friday. For people who are not familiar with my books and stuff, I've written and traveled extensively throughout former Soviet Central Asia. And I know you've been to not maybe the Central Asian republics, but you've been to a lot of former Soviet republics. So, yeah. You know, and you've lived there. So you know this dynamic very well. So I think we should just get to it. If you're watching live in the 9 a.m. Eastern time hour, this Tuesday morning, please put your questions and comments into the live chat on YouTube and Rumble. As always, we really appreciate your support. So if you do choose to do a super chat or a Rumble rant, which means that goes with a donation, we will prioritize those and answer your questions first. And we'll be really appreciative, but we appreciate all the questions. And we know not everybody is in a position to be able to donate. So we appreciate you just being here to watch. Okay, so with that, what do you want to do first, JT? You want to do the airlines? You want to do the Tuaregs or Karimova?
Let's do Mali.
Okay,
because the Mali thing fascinates me. So over the weekend, there were reports of a terrorist attack on Mali. Now, to be honest, it's not really a terrorist attack. It's more like a proxy army that attacked the country itself, trying to take over multiple locations, including the capital. The Russian forces.
Where do they come in from? Are they in a neighboring country or?
So the belief is that they're Western forces. Basically, France is trying to get its hands back on its former colonial possession. Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger formed the Sahel states. Mm-hmm. And they were able to basically form governments to throw off, let's say, colonial overreach in the context of their quote-unquote democracies, which weren't really democracies at all, which was part of the reason why the public supports all of these governments. They kicked the French out. They kicked the Americans out. They did both. France has never really gotten over that, nor has America really gotten over that, especially with the Russian influence in the Sahel states providing security and stability for the governments of those countries. A proxy force of thousands, I think from 10 to 20,000, because the reports differ between the number of people that were involved in this, but it was a force. And it was almost like this kind of Syrian style attack that succeeded in Syria, but failed in Mali. Part of the reason it failed is because the Russian and Mali defense response. Africa Corps from the Russian side worked with the Mali government in order to push back the terrorist attacks in most of the main locations. I think the terrorists were able to take Kindal, K-I-D-A-L, but for the most part, the government and whatnot were preserved and maintained with thousands of dead terrorists who were trying to take over the government. This was a way for the West to effectively undercut the influence, A, of Russia in the region, but B, also the fact that these Sahel states are not aligned with France, not aligned with the United States, and effectively are charting their own way in Africa.
These are mostly military juntas, right, at this point?
Yeah, they're juntas. Mm-hmm. They are. But they're juntas that are supported by the population. And honestly, you can make it. Let's talk about that for a moment. Mm-hmm. Military juntas. Under normal circumstances, from the standpoint of countries like the U.S., we look at those things as being problematic. Mm-hmm. However, if you have a, quote, democracy, and that democracy still includes, let's say, imperial influence from countries like France. Like, for example, Niger. France was able to get uranium and other materials dirt cheap. And the democracy, as they call it, allowed France to do it, effectively screwing over the government itself.
With cheap under market concessions. Radically. It should have benefited the people, but instead did not.
Exactly. And it was like radically undervalued. If you look at, let's say, the economics of the country. So let's say the gold mines being owned by somebody else, the materials being owned by other countries. Meaning the juntas, yeah, as Americans, I guess I think we're going to be dodgy of juntas in general, right? By the same token.
Well, we used to love them, so it all depends.
Well, as long as we work with them, right? Yeah. As long as we're working with the government. But in this particular case, these juntas took over specifically in order to overthrow what they considered to be over too much influence of, let's say, France in the previous colonial possessions. So even though France said, okay, you're your own country, it was never that case. They were never their own country. And the democracy was a way of France managing that country by proxy. Juntas overthrew it. The people resoundingly approved of it. You have people carrying Russian flags, effectively with this idea of pushing back on the French.
We have to talk about that. You can go on, but we got to talk about, like, how on earth did Russia get involved there? How did they become popular there? Is it the Russian government, or is it the Wagner Group, mercenary organization? Like, which is it? And all that. Because, I mean, it is, because it sounds to, but to American ears, it's like, why is Russia in West Africa?
Because, I mean, you can ask, why is America in Africa?
Right? Sure. But historically, and historically we haven't been really, except for Liberia.
Well, in the Russian case, so there were a few things. When Russia was fighting Ukraine, despite all the propaganda that was taking place in the West, Russia attacked, you know, for no reason. Putin just wants to expand his empire all throughout
right.
Europe.
He's trying to put the band back together, yeah.
Yeah, they're trying to put the Soviet Union. The rest of the world didn't necessarily accept that as true. That was just stuff that was pumped out to the West. Mm-hmm. If you were a country that was colonized, if you were a country that had, let's say, a terrorist issue that you're associated with Western powers, if you had, because a lot of people believe that the terrorism was coming from the West in order to create a reason and a justification for the U.S. or, for that matter, for the French to be involved in those countries. Basically, we're pushing these guys to behave this way and using them as an excuse to effectively be involved in the country itself. So when they saw Russia effectively standing against all of the West, they used that as a rallying cry. It was like, whoa, you mean Russia is fighting the great empire? You mean Russia's fighting all of these countries? They looked at it as a way of pushing back, meaning from the standpoint of people carrying Russian flags.
Well, there are also historic ties, right, between the old Soviet. We're talking, today's theme yes. seems to be the Soviet Union, right? And obviously the USSR was tied up with the non-aligned movement and with the and was the leading force of anti-colonialism in Africa from the outside. Yes. You know, obviously the people it's Africans who led that, but they got the most assistance. When Nelson Mandela was inaugurated as head of the ANC in South Africa, there were Soviet flags side by side with South African flags. And a lot of Americans were like, what's with that? And he said, like, these people were the only outsiders who ever helped us.
Yeah. And it's so true. And in this particular case, you know, it's like the reality of it is, if you are throwing off the yoke of imperialistic reach, you're going to be a target. Mm-hmm. And from their point of view, it helped to have, let's say a big brother that is also a nuclear power, that is also a military power, to help stabilize and protect the government when you know you're in under threat. Meaning, it's not like the French said, okay, we're going to let them do their own thing. That's not the way they looked at it. In fact, the terrorism in the region was suspected or looked at as coming from Western sources. If you notice, ISIS never attacked Israel. In fact, Israel was actually providing support to ISIS. And right. Even the jihadists.
Yes, they were directly across the border from Israel.
Yes, they are. And they never attacked.
There's some Vice documentaries where Vice reporters went into ISIS-controlled Syria. They crossed from the Golan Heights, which is Israeli-occupied Syria.
Yes, that's my point. There was never, meaning for all of this talk about, oh my God, these guys are terrorists, oh my God, these guys are Muslim jihadists. It's very weird that the only places these animals attack are targets of the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's very strange. So it's like,
we armed them and funded them. I know people think that's a conspiracy theory. It's not like it's a robust, full-fledged alliance. But we funneled them shit. There's no question about that.
Under Obama, Obama gave billions to try to overthrow Syria and did so for years, effectively arming terrorist groups in order to do so. Go back and look at Tulsi Gabbard. When Tulsi Gabbard went on CNN and Tulsi Gabbard was like, we're arming terrorists, Jake was like, well, what do you mean? What do you mean?
What
do you mean? She's like, we're arming terrorists. Because we were arming terrorists. When Obama got out of office, the New York Times published a massive article talking about Obama spending billions of dollars to overthrow the Syrian government. It just so happened it took longer than he thought.
Now,
and I'm saying,
Molly was
seeing terrorists.
So I'm sorry, Jamal, but I mean, a lot of people might be watching and saying, why do we care about Mali? Why should we care about West Africa? Mali is desperately poor. Yes, it was the center of the world at one point, literally. I mean, it really was the center of like global culture when Timbuktu was at its peak. But that's long gone. Now it's poor and desperate and war-torn and full of rocks. Why do we care?
Because right now, what is taking place around the world is, I would argue, a third world war with multiple fronts. That is not recognized as a third world war, because ultimately the way the media reports it as if these things are separate. Oh, these things are separate spheres. They're not separate spheres. If you're talking about the war with Russia and Ukraine, okay, that is all of the West, including the United States, going after Russia. If you're looking at the attack on Iran, again, this is the US, the same participant in that war on Iran, going after Iran with Israel, using it as the tip of the spear. And then when you look at Africa, once again, what do you have? Is the US, France, backing a terrorist group to try to take over one of the Sahel states in order to undermine all of the Sahel states. Again, entities that are aligned with Russia. I'm saying that all of these wars are effectively the same participants in different spheres. Mm-hmm. The only one that is not necessarily involved militarily is China. But if you're talking about how influence and how the U.S. is effectively trying to maintain hegemony, whether it's in Africa, whether it's in Europe, or whether that's in Asia, it's the same conflict. It's just in different spheres, different lenses. That's why it matters. Because mm-hmm. this is not like rando attack in Africa that has nothing to do with anything. It has everything to do with everything else that has taken place around the world.
And Mali's also geostrategically important, right? It's between a lot of other important things. Burkina Faso has oil reserves. West Africa has extensive oil reserves offshore. Sure. Yeah, and so it's like, so there could be potential pipeline routes there. Mali's a migration route between sub-Saharan Africa and North Africa, which is a feeder line into Southern Europe and a lot of the migrants who drown in the Mediterranean and all that. I mean, it's sort of like Afghanistan. It's not necessarily all about what happens there, but it's like about where it is and what it's in between.
Also, don't forget the Sahel states. Like, these states are somewhat unaligned or non-aligned. And if you end up with a situation, like if you remember when they pulled out of ECOWAS, the French were trying to get the Nigerians to attack another African country.
Right.
At the behest of the French. Mm-hmm. Like, meaning it mattered to them. They were like, hey, what do you mean we're going to get the uranium at, percent on a dollar. What do you mean we're not going to be able to get the oil? What do you mean you're over, you know, changing your oil?
And Niger has a lot of uranium. People might remember the whole run-up to the war against Iraq and the trip to Niger with Valerie Plame's husband and that whole fiasco back, 25 years ago. Yeah. It's a lot of uranium. I mean, obviously, and that's super important.
One last point about but I think more relevant is people like Ibrahim Traore being able to show kind of a new way for Africa. Mm. There was concern that in addition to these three states, the other states were also going to effectively have hunters to take over and get more aligned with the AES countries. If you remember, there was an attempted overthrow of, was it Namibia? No, not Namibia. It was a coastal country in Africa, but it was also in West Africa. My point is, part of the concern is...
Well, there was Côte d'Ivoire, right?
Thank you. That was it. Côte d'Ivoire. It failed, though. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my point is, part of the concern is that this becomes a trend, that other states in Africa... Because look, the problem with Africa, honestly, when I've had guests on who talked about the African thing, had to do with self-governance. That they've been colonized for so long that many of the governments that are in play are not necessarily in control of their own affairs. Nigeria, for example, the guy that was on Nigeria was effectively a U.S. puppet. And if I'm not mistaken, the guy was from Chicago. And it's like they're exerting control over these countries in a way that they don't control their own airwaves, their information space, their economies, even things like mining, those type of things are owned by other sources that effectively pull resources out of the country itself. And whatever you want to say to the junta, one of the things that they effectively did was take control of their natural resources.
So have they nationalized the foreign mining concessions?
Yep. Yeah, the gold reserves.
Well, that's gonna keep things spicy. I mean, look, the United States still isn't over the nationalizations that the Castro government did in Cuba in 1959. Right. They're not over. Yeah.
And they don't like the idea of, let's say, these guys being self-determinant in a way that they weren't prior. So yes, it's all of the economic stuff, but it's also just, what does it mean to have somebody like Ibrahim Traore seen as almost like a political icon? I mean, when he went to Russia, he got standing ovation and the people in the streets came out for him and defended. In fact, even in the last attack that took place, you had people, regular people in the streets who were grabbing some of the people who were effectively attacking the country, meaning they were defending their government, despite the fact that it's a junta running the government. So I found the story fascinating. And I know some people would be like, okay, I don't see why this is a big deal. Africa in the coming years will be far more significant.
Going forward. Well, a lot of people recognize that. China certainly recognizes that. They're trying to spread their influence economically. They don't want to invade and occupy anyone. They just want to rent them.
Yeah. I want to build hospitals. I want to build bridges. I want to build schools. I want you to like me for the things that I've built, not necessarily for just putting military.
And maybe you'll view me, if it's between me and another bidder on a project, maybe I'll have an advantage.
Yep.
Maybe you'll like me better.
Yeah. Yeah. Charm offensive.
Total charm offensive. Yeah, no, it is fascinating. So what do you think is going to happen here? I mean, the thing about, like, again, the theme of the, a lot of former Soviet republics had borderlines that turned out to be problematic in a post-Soviet environment when you became 15 independent nations. Similarly, a lot of African borders were very poorly drawn, usually intentionally by typically British cartographers. Now we have... Mali is definitely kind of maybe a bigger, it doesn't look so big because of the Mercator projection, but it's actually a big country. It's maybe it's kind of divided between these tribal factions and the urban versus rural divide, I guess, which we see everywhere. But I mean, can Mali hold together, is a question, or is that just remains to be seen?
I mean, I think so. I mean, the people I talked to about it, they pointed out that, yeah, the terrorists were able to take Kiddo, but for the most part, they failed in the objectives of overthrowing the government of the country itself, and that the military is probably going to regroup and regain Kiddo. Meaning, basically, the locations that they took, Mali is not necessarily going to just let them hold those possessions. I think the most interesting thing is this idea of self-defense and how you can make a case that says time is up. That the fact that you have a terrorist force of like 20,000 people that basically raided the capital, that they were able to kill the defense minister, that is problematic. And that
that's
is
a
an
big
indication.
Deal.
Yeah, that's a big deal. That shouldn't happen, right?
Well, so what about the French? Are they, I mean, look, I feel like President Emmanuel Macron is in his last year as president.
Yes.
He's term limited out. And, you know, he's about as popular as lint. So he's going to be gone. I mean, he's got his hands full. And I think that's a big part of why he, you know, pulled. Also, he's young. And I think that he's not that interested in French colonization, right? But that could easily change under a right-wing government next year. And which is likely to, I mean, I could see Jordan Baldella, who is Marine Le Pen's, she can't run because of a court ruling, but her protege. I mean, the tradition in post-colonial independent Africa, starting in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, was that the former colonial power is expected, or certainly viewed itself as entitled, to wade in when there's a crisis or something that calls for Europe or the, you know, Whitelandia's attention, right? So, you know, Rwanda, for example, right? When the genocide happened there in the mid-1990s, the expectation there was that the French or the Belgians were going to come in and ultimately put it out. And they did. That is ultimately what happened. If something were to go down in Congo now, people might, despite the horrific history there, like, might turn to Belgium and say, hey, can you guys help out? Is that tradition done? I think that tradition is kind of finished, right? I don't think the French are going to wait. Just, it's not going to be like, well, France, this is your thing. You know, you made Mali. This used to be yours. Now you have to send the Foreign Legion back, right?
Well, the entire point of the overthrow was to get rid of French influence.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's, I mean, like, who
like
the hell is that?
That's finished, right? And the French don't have the appetite for it, really.
I don't know if they have the appetite. You'll know better than me on that one, whether the French have the appetite. I would say they don't like the fact that the government or that they were removed. And the entire point of
it's a blow to French prestige, for sure.
It may be a blow to French
prestige. But frankly, it's, you know, decolonization is like the best thing that can happen to a big power, right? France is better off without its colonies. You know, Britain is better off without its colonies. They literally save money. They can focus on their own countries. They can build high speed rail. They can quit fucking around. They're no longer a target for their interests are no longer a target for military or terrorist attacks. You're just better off minding your own fucking business in this world.
Yeah, no, I get that, but who the F are they? That's what I feel.
Well, yeah,
like this internal relationship. It should, like, that stuff needs to stop. These are grown people. They need to be able to function on their own. They don't want them there. Part of the reason that the people were celebrating the French leaving and protesting the French leaving was because they don't want them there. So, yes, I get the sense that that's over with, but that is not what is happening.
Goodbye to all that, as the famous essay said. Let's bring Robbie has some housekeeping, so I'm going to put him in. And also, as Robbie pointed out, thank you for the reminder. Right before we went on the air, the United Arab Emirates announced that it is withdrawing from both OPEC and OPEC Plus. And I wanted to sort of break down the implications of that. So anyway, go ahead, Robbie.
Whoa.
Oh, Robbie, you are muted. I see you muted.
Yep, I'm a moron. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to drop a link into both chats for a social media site that we are active on that's called Pickaxe. And the reason why I'm doing this is because there's no algorithm there, and your favorite cartoonist posts weekly columns there every week. And people have been saying, how can I find Ted's columns? I can't find them anywhere on X. I can't find them anywhere. If you click on the link to Pickaxe, follow Ted Rall. He's the only Ted Rall that's there because we have the best Ted Rall. You will be able to see all of his weekly columns, and also I will be animating more of his cartoons going up today. Y'all may have noticed there were no clips or shorts posted yesterday. That's because I was very busy and did not have a chance to do it. So I'll be getting caught up on all that stuff today.
Thank you very much, Robbie. Do we have an ad by any chance? I can answer that question, can't I?
You can.
Let me even see. Dollar sign. I'm going to get good at this. I'm going to learn how to do this. I see no ads currently. Okay. All right. Thank you, Robbie. So UAE is out of OPEC and OPEC Plus. Basically, it seems that they want to produce, they have capacity in excess of 5 million barrels a day. And that capacity is mainly sitting idle. And they would like to export more oil. They would like to produce and export more. They're annoyed by the OPEC cartel's limitations on how much they're allowed to produce. That's what a cartel does, right? Like a cartel basically says, we're not going to unleash too much supply onto the market in order to keep the prices up. I mean, certainly no danger of the prices not being high enough now. I guess the question is, JT, are we going to? I'm not seeing any reporting to this, but to this effect, but the UAE is bottlenecked by the Strait of Hormuz. They are now effectively controlled by Iran. Could they be seeing the writing on the wall and realizing that they're going to have to maybe not necessarily make nice, but reach some sort of accommodation with Iran in order to be able to do business in the future? And could this be related, or is this sort of a decision that may have just been in the making pre-war, and now we're just seeing the aftermath of it?
No, I don't think it was in the making pre-war. Something else is going on. So Saudi Arabia is at odds with the UAE. They are bumping heads big time, especially over the war. Saudi Arabia, for example, the UAE put a thing saying that it needed the United States to effectively compensate it in some way, like basically to have money swaps because it was running out of cash. The UAE also, was it Saudi Arabia? The UAE was pissed off at Pakistan also because Pakistan was holding the negotiations with Iran, effectively saying, if you're going to be neutral to Iran, we're going to be pissed off at you because Iran has been hitting our oil fields. Saudi Arabia has been backing Pakistan in regards to these negotiations, which has put Saudi Arabia and UAE at odds, and they've been at odds for a while. This is astonishing. I mean, UAE has been part of that since, 1967? I think the report
said. That's exactly correct. Yeah. Via Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, that's 80 years?
Yeah, it's a long time. No, it's not that long. I was born in 1963, so it's 59.
40, 50, 60. I'm sorry, 60 years. You're right. I'm sorry. I'm mad. Never do math. One air. it's like you're trying to work that. I was like, 80. Yeah, 80.
Sometimes I feel 80.
It's a long time to be part of a process and for that process to effectively break down. Normally, when they are at odds, they still stay part of OPEC. Meaning, regardless of the odds that Saudi Arabia and UAE had over the years, they've stayed intact. And now they're like, we're out. This is directly related to the war. There's no way around it. Now, the question is, what does it mean? And that's more, but
yeah,
I need time to think about that. I just saw this on air. I don't even want to speculate.
Well,
on air.
I mean, look, UAE is like Israel's ass boy and also America's ass boy. So, yes. I mean, it seems to me like if I'm sitting in Riyadh, I'm throwing, golden dinner plates at the wall and saying, you fucking assholes, you're scabs. You just want to undercut us and depress the price of oil. And, so that you can basically, take the pressure that Iran off the necks of the Americans and the West. That's all this is about. And the Israelis.
How does it get through the Strait of Hormuz?
They can't get through. That's my question. They can't get through the Strait of Hormuz. I don't think any pipelines solve their problems, because they still have the Red Sea to deal with. They still have the Houthis to deal with. And the Iranians don't even need the Houthis to close that up, right?
No.
So, I mean, I don't know. It might turn out to just be like, there's something going on here that we're not.
They're pissed off at Saudi Arabia. They are. There's been, if you look in the media reports, Saudi Arabia and UAE have been at odds over the fact of the Iran war. Iran was able to hit multiple locations. The UAE. The UAE is pissed off that they were able to hit multiple locations in the UAE. And they're pissed off at Pakistan. And they're pissed off at Saudi Arabia. Meaning, the war has created divisions that weren't necessarily there, or the very least that didn't bubble up to the degree that they're bubbling up now.
Yeah,
I guess my thing is your question. It's like, yeah, you pull out of OPEC, but you still can't get your oil from point A to point B.
No.
I mean, even if Donald Trump loves the fact that you pull out of OPEC because it splits the cartel, you still can't get your oil up. I mean,
that's exactly it. That's exactly it. I'm like, you guys do own a map, right? I mean, I don't understand.
But I think it has to do with the divisions between Saudi Arabia and the UAE and the fact that Iran has been hitting UAE. I mean, it hit Saudi Arabia too, but UAE has been taking a beating. So, fascinating. Just fascinating. It I guess my thing is, what does it mean? That's the part that I'm unclear on. I'm going to have to get somebody to talk about it.
All right, let's answer a few questions here. Okay, well, we'll talk about that. We're getting to the airline afterwards. Oh, thanks very much for the donation, Black Spock. Much appreciated. Ted and JT, Flandarina, what's your take on Ukraine expressing anger and frustration with Russia for selling seized Ukrainian wheat to should-be Ukrainian allies like Israel? Zelensky is said to be planning sanctions. What sanctions could he plan? He's at war. War is the biggest sanction you could impose.
Right. Look, man, Russia, if I understand the question right, Russia has an odd relationship with Israel. Mm-hmm. It's just strange. And even when I've had people to talk about it, they're like, yeah, it's kind of strange, especially Putin's relationship in essence. Doesn't shock me, unfortunately.
Right.
It's weird.
Yeah, it is weird.
And just be clear, the U.S. being a close ally to Israel and the United States at war with the U.S., like, it's very strange in the way that it operates.
Totally. All right, we got to talk about this Uzbek story because it's so interesting. So Uzbekistan is a particularly natural gas, but also oil producing state in former Soviet Central Asia. Most notable because it is the only Central Asian republic out of the seven with borders that touch all of the other ones: Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, so on. It's also the one with the biggest cities, including Tashkent, which is big enough to have its own metro system. If you fly for many years, the only city you could fly into from outside of the former Soviet Union into Central Asia was Tashkent. The only city with banking was Tashkent, right? So it's like the metropolis. And it was run in the post-Soviet era by this guy, Islam Karimov, who basically all the former Soviet Central Asian republics until like the late 90s were all run by their former Soviet party boss. And Karimov was one of those. He's dead now. But while he was in power, his family was looted the shit out of Uzbekistan. And no one was more flamboyant or over the top than his daughter Gulnara. So Gulnara was basically like, they called her the princess of Uzbekistan, even though, of course, it's technically not a kingdom. But, you know, even though it has a tradition of monarchy, going back to the emirates of Bukhara and Kiva and Samarkand. Anyway, the point is, Gulnara was so over the top. She was basically partying like it was, you know, 1855, 1899 with the people's money. The people were desperately poor, right? Like the average income there until like 2000 was $20 a month. The level of the police were not paid. So basically you'd encounter the police every like kilometer or so if you were driving or walking, and they'd be shaking you down. People, you just see, like, suddenly if you were walking in the crowd, you see people running away. You'd be like, oh, a cop's coming. And you just know to run the same direction as everyone else. Otherwise, you're going to be shaken down for money, especially if you're a foreigner. So, I mean, the point is the level of corruption is unfathomable, okay? It's like, even by Central Asian standards. And anyway, Gulnara also was a singer. She released CDs and albums. She went on tour. I mean, so she was basically like, I'm trying to think if there's an example of anyone's, there's kind of like really kind of like nothing else like it. She was the Imelda Marcos of Central Asia. She was insane. Okay. And so ultimately, you know, her father died And then there was a rupture within the system, and the new president ultimately had her imprisoned. So she's being kept in, I'm sure, very pleasant conditions in this Soviet era, you know, prison colony in Western Uzbekistan. And now she's been extradited by the Swiss, but the Swiss can't get her because she's in prison in Uzbekistan. They decided to go ahead and put her on trial. According to the Swiss, and I suspect the Swiss are probably right here, she ran a crime ring called the Office that involved several dozen people, multiple shell corporations, and she is accused of basically depositing funds in the form of gold, silver bars, cash, jewelry, crypto, you name it, everything. You know, basically in safety deposit boxes, in numbered accounts. She was, I think it might be impossible to understand how much money this woman and her cronies grifted out of Uzbekistan. Yeah. And it's like, I guess the question is, I have a bunch of questions here. First of all, does it make any sense to try someone in absentia at all? I mean, they don't have the ability to defend themselves by definition, right? I mean,
yeah, I guess,
a country like Switzerland.
I guess they're looking at it. Oh, yeah, I guess they're looking at it as a trial on principle. Like from the standpoint of a government, we've convicted this person if this person comes. But yeah, that's right. They don't have the ability to defend themselves. That's the issue. Mm-hmm. Like many people have a right to self-defense, right?
And it's not like she's refusing to come. I think she probably would rather be on trial in a Swiss courtroom than where she is now.
You think they have better prisons?
Oh.
It's like I can move up into my prison.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, that's a really good question. Does it make sense to be tried in absentia? Would she go to Switzerland for that trial if she was out?
Well, that part I don't know. But let's just say she were given a choice right now, like the Swiss were to visit her in prison and say, you can either come with us or you can stay here.
She'd go.
She should. That would be the wise move. I doubt she's protected where she is now.
See, I don't know. I've never been to Uzbekistan, so I don't know what it looks like in practice. And like to know what their jails and stuff like that look like. But
imagine bleak. Now multiply by bleak by 1,000.
If she was a princess, so how did she get caught? I mean, what did they do? The moment that the new president came in, they prosecuted.
It wasn't the moment, but it was like basically, they were like, this woman's out of control. She makes Uzbek. And the thing is, she was also like an international party animal, right? She was in the gossip pages, like in Paris Match magazine. She was always hobnobbing with celebs. She tried to release her albums in the West and tried to become a big star. I mean, there was a time period when she was on page 6 of the New York Post. I mean, Gulnara. I mean, do you remember Angelique in LA? Do you know who I'm talking about? Uh-huh. Is it Angelique? No, it's not Angelique. What is her name? Oh my God, it's going to come to me. There is a woman who's famous for being famous in LA. She's just a big, brassy blonde with big boobs. And there's just a picture of her and her first name on billboards all over Los Angeles, and it's been there for like 30 years. And nobody knows what she does or what she's up to. And basically, she's famous for being famous. Her husband basically pays for these ads. And that's kind of like what Gulnara was like.
Interesting.
Angeline, that's what it is. Angeline, thank you very much, Razzmatazz.
Interesting. So she was like the original socialite for Uzbekistan. Interesting. I mean, look, I don't know if there's a purpose in trying somebody in absentia. I mean, maybe it's a legal issue more than anything else. Would she go to trial if it was a better prison? Well, yeah, it's a step up if it's a better prison, right? And Switzerland is probably going to have different laws and probably going to have limited time. Do you know how long she's in that prison? Like how long they've
given her? I don't think she's served. It's an indeterminate sentencing. Basically, look, Uzbekistan's a dictatorship, okay? I mean, it's a brutal, tyrannical dictatorship. So they basically, law isn't really a big part of the equation there.
So is this a political prosecution?
100%. Not that she doesn't have it coming.
It sounds like she's just a party girl. But the embezzlement was from Uzbekistan. So there is a reason for the prosecution. Oh, what I'm trying to get at is
she has raped the Uzbek people and the treasury for years. So, I mean, basically, there's two, in the I don't know if this is what's the case in the former Soviet republics that you were in, although I would suspect it was, but you tell me. But like, basically, there's two models in former Soviet Central Asia, right? Which is the Kazakh model, where you basically the ruling family, they grift and they skim off the top, but they share most of the oil wealth with the people. And so basically it provides social and political stability, and everybody's in on it together, but the ruling families, you know, still get the lion's share. Then there's the Turkmen and the Uzbek model, where basically the ruling family takes everything, and millions of ordinary people are starving to death, and basically barely able to subsist. And then there's sort of the Kyrgyz and Tajik models, which is like they putter along the best you can because you don't really have any natural resources to steal in the first place.
Oh, I see. So Azerbaijan functions on oil money, and there's a mafia-style government in office. If you remember, Azerbaijan got real pissed off at Russia because Russia started locking up mobs, like mafia, that just so happened to be in Russia. And it's like, hey, you seem to have very strong feelings with the fact that they're locking up mafia people, right? It's like, why does it care that Russia is locking up the mob? Well, obvious, right? So there's that. Georgia, I'm not sure about Georgia's political system, to be honest. Pashinyan is...
is it still Aliyev in Azerbaijan? Is it still President Aliyev, or is it someone else?
Yes, Aliyev. He's still president. Yeah, he's still president. When I went to play chess with this woman who owned the chess club, she was very strong. Her brother was like second strongest in the world. But she plays in tournaments, and Aliyev is sitting there, you know, shaking hands with all these guys. So yeah, it's still Aliyev. Pashinyan is Armenia. I forget who's running Georgia. But Georgia was more complicated. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, the ins and outs of the government of Georgia. I pay more attention politically to the government of Azerbaijan just because of its proximity to Iran and the fact that it was in a less transparent way, allowing its airwaves to be open to attacks on Iran, not to mention the Caucasus and what the United States is trying to do with this kind of freedom.
And then Belarus is basically in a national union with Russia now.
Yes. Yes. You mean Azerbaijan?
They're not merged, but they're like...
It's complicated. Mm-hmm. Because if you remember, they were at odds. They were at serious odds at one point, like going back last year. I'm not quite sure where they are now. I mean, they were talking about patching it up. But part of the issue that they're having is this kind of freedom corridor that the United States is trying to get its hands on. Basically, Trump wants to be able to get inroads into the Caucasus. Something that Iran, Russia, China are going to really have issues with. This is way beyond the point. I'm sorry. It's hard for me to answer those questions. I could say that Azerbaijan is more into the mafia thing. Georgia, I'm unclear.
So are you saying mafia? Because there is, of course, all these former Soviet spaces have actual mafia. Or are you talking mafia-like governance, which is not the same?
I mean the mob. Like mob. Because there were infiltrations into Russia that was taking place associated with Russia calling it the mob. Basically, what we would consider the mob in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
The government itself took issue with Russia putting what Russia considered to be criminals who were part of a criminal enterprise in jails. If you remember, it was Russian media that was, I believe it was Azerbaijan, where they beat the shit out of the press. I mean, some of the people had black eyes and everything else, but that was their response to Russia locking up people who were in the mob. And so it was like this kind of wild situation where it's like, whoa, why are you taking issue with Russia putting obvious mob people, like people who were obviously involved with the mafia in Azerbaijan that infiltrated Russia, that was into criminal enterprises in Russia?
Yeah, you don't understand. Why are you taking issue? Mob is nothing, or was nothing, compared to these people. Oh my God, I have so many stories. But like, you know, for example, if you walked into a bar or a disco anywhere in a former Soviet republic back in the 90s or the aughts, and I'm sure this is true now, and the place is empty. And you just look at it, you just choose a table. And you'd see the waitstaff, like I learned this, if you'd see them have a look of sheer terror, now I know to get up and move to and be like, is this other table okay? And they'd be like, yeah, this, like, хорошо, which means okay in Russian. Like, that's cool. Because, because that table is the mafia table. Now, the odds are the mafia guys never come in there, ever, ever. But if they saw someone sitting at their table, you know, guns are going to come out. Everyone's going to die, right?
What?
I mean, like, my favorite of these stories was in, this was, I guess, in the late 90s. Things were really crazy. They still are. I was in Urumqi in Western China. And I had just taken the train from Beijing, been in China for 3.5 weeks. I'm a coffee addict, right? And it's like, so no coffee in China. All the tea in China, right? No coffee.
Yeah.
So, but I'm like, I wake up in Urumqi. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in the Muslim zone. What Muslims, you know what Islam means? Yes, it means Allah. It means coffee. So I'm like, okay. So I go out and ask, like, where can I get a cup of coffee? They're like, the Holiday Inn. So in Urumqi, I'm like, so the Holiday Inn there is like a 4-star hotel. So I go over to the Holiday Inn and I walk into a scene right out of a Quentin Tarantino movie. There are bodies everywhere, blood splatters all over the walls, on the furniture.
What?
It's like, it's mayhem, probably like 15 people dead. The cops have just arrived and they're just trying to figure it out. Waitstaff is dead. Everyone's dead, right? Like, so I talked to the cops, the Chinese cop, and they go, oh, this shit happens all the time. It's fucking Russian and Kazakh mobsters. They're 4 hours away on the highway from the border. They come over here. They're looking for one guy. They don't really know what he looks like. So just, they know he's here. So just to be safe, they kill everybody, including the waitstaff. And so this, and I'm like, how often? They're like, oh, this is like all the time. Like, we're used to it. And they were like relaxed about it. They're like literally like in a Quentin Tarantino movie, like mopping up the blood. And I mean, that was a routine for them. And by the
you
way,
I did
get that cup of coffee. A waiter shows up later. And he's like stunned. And I'm like, you can make me coffee, right? And he's like, yeah.
Are you serious? So they're like dead bodies all over the place.
Dollars for a cup of coffee. I was so pissed for fucking Nescafe. But like, anyway, whatever.
But dead. I think you missed the context. There were all these dead bodies. And you're responsible.
I needed that. Do you nip? Okay, I'm a coffee addict. I don't know if you understand. Yeah, I had to have it. It's been a month. I was dying. Anyway, so
apparently a lot of people were.
The mafia is crazy. All right. So, I mean, those people weren't going to be any less dead if I didn't have my cup of coffee.
True.
Manchild, a Swiss banker on trial, said they didn't know they were laundering money. They just had too many confusing rules. Is Swiss banking the world's most expensive game of, I didn't see that memo? Look. As a former Japanese banker, I was not Japanese, but I worked for a Japanese bank. Let me just say that money laundering is a standard thing that all international bankers do every single fucking day. And you know you're doing it. And there's no question about it. And you have, I guess, some plausible deniability in that you don't know the source and you know, or you might suspect. But if you're not told, you don't really have any obligation. And anyway, nothing would ever get done if people were turning in these people because that's all there is. It's like there's so much graft and illegality. Money laundering is normal. I don't know. I just feel like the Swiss know. And by the way, the Swiss don't guarantee you're safe. It's not like the 1960s. Your money's not safe in Switzerland. If you really want privacy, go to Luxembourg. It's much better. They don't really know who you are, and so they can't turn you in. Attic Scorpion, thanks for the $4. Have you guys seen the new Michael Jackson movie? And if so, what did you think of it?
Michael Jackson?
Have you heard about it?
No. I didn't even know they had another movie. Movie for what? I mean, what? Look, I need context.
There's a new movie. It is being criticized roundly for not getting into the child abuse the pedophilia accusations, I guess I should say. Basically it sort of ends before all of that. And so it's kind of like, I think it's the general take, and I have not seen this, so I don't know if it's fair or not, is that it's a whitewash.
If being molested by Michael Jackson cures cancer. Now, this sounds outrageous. Do you remember? All right. So do you remember when they did that, Michael Jackson did that disastrous interview? And in an interview, there was this kid, and the kid kept rubbing and hugging on Michael Jackson. It was so weird. And the kid had cancer. Mm-hmm. And it was like, being molested by Michael Jackson cures cancer. It's like, okay. Bad joke. Fair enough. But that, talk about an interview that was worse than an interview with Chris Andrews, I think. Where Chris Andrews made the argument that
That's pretty
said I sweat too much and I couldn't sweat anymore because when I was in the war, it scared me shitless and I stopped, lost the ability to sweat. So obviously she's lying when she's saying I was a heavy sweater. And it's like, what? What are you saying right now? It looked super weird that that kid was rubbing and hugging on Michael Jackson. And people saw it and were like, whoa, what's
going on? Yeah, it's very weird.
It's like, it's good for a man to give his love to a child. It's like, what?
Not really. No, not really. I think to me the worst interview anyone's ever given ever is Gary Condit. Given the fact that he turned out to be innocent, right?
Yeah.
Gary Condit did not kill Chandra Levy, but he looked so fucking guilty and like so creepy. Everyone was convinced that he had, and that was the end of him. I mean, that's a bad interview.
What? And who's Gary Condit? Give me
context. He's the guy who was accused of killing Chandra Levy. He was a congressman from Northern Central California, and he was accused of killing. He had an affair with his intern. And
yeah, don't get those interviews. I know you may think the interview is coming out right. Don't get those interviews. Somebody should have told Prince Andrews, don't do that.
That's a good question, right? Like people who are in crisis, they often end up, you know. I mean, back in the day, they'd go on with Barbara Walters or whatever. I don't know. Like, I'm trying to think, is there an example in crisis management where someone who's beleaguered like that gives an interview and then it helps? Oh, I guess Bill and Hillary Clinton during the 1992 Democratic primaries when there were the bimbo eruptions.
Yeah.
I think it did help quell things. But it's Hillary who really did it.
See, the issue is, you want to explain yourself, but the moment that you have a conversation, it splits. Mm. Like if you and I get into an argument, it will fracture. There'll be some people who think I'm right. There'll be some people who think you're right. And by the way, this could be with one of us being completely wrong.
Right.
And so when you're in an interview like that and you're like, okay, I have to deal with allegations that I was sexually abusing women with Epstein. How do you get out of that interview convincingly? I don't know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it. Bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, no, it's true. I think generally speaking, you're better off. I mean, unless you're truly innocent, pure as the driven snow, and you can, I mean, part of the issue is like, you have to also be able to convey how angry you are, right? There's the fugitive case, right? That the movie is based on. The doctor in Cleveland who really didn't kill his wife, but he was such a cold fish that he didn't cry and like, I didn't do whatever, said that the jury didn't believe him and sent him off to prison, right? I mean,
part of the problem is people are different. Oh, somebody's frozen. Are you frozen, Ted? Can you guys hear me? Can you guys hear me? Is it me or is it Ted?
That's frozen. Nope, I hear you. It's Ted.
Oh, okay. Look, part of the problem is people are looking at you from the perspective of their perspective. I give an example. My mom and I were watching this film. You get the situation where she looks at it and says, the big guy's going to be a problem. I was like, the big guy has nothing to do with this. This is about love. This is about the relationship. This is about the couple and everything else. Meaning, how people see you is based on their own experiences. And one person may be unemotional. Somebody else may be overly emotional. And they're looking at that and they're judging you by themselves, which is a problem.
There we go. There you are. Okay, we all froze up there for a second.
Might have been me. That was 100% you. You failed, sir. You choked like a French.
I just want to go on record and say, fuck Spirit Airlines and fuck these fucking airlines that want a $2.5 billion like bailout from the taxpayers. I mean, these are shitty airlines. They're not too big to fail. They give shit. There's so many consumer complaints about them. As far as I'm concerned, they can all go under.
Why do they want to? What is their reason? What is their argument for the $2 billion or whatever the hell they're trying to get from?
Oh, you're gonna die of laughter. It's the war. Because the U.S. attacked Iran, and so all the oil prices have gone way up. So jet fuel prices are way up. And unlike the big carriers like American, United, and Delta, these smaller carriers don't hedge themselves with oil futures. So they're buying jet fuel at the old prices, so they can't stay afloat. Spirit was already in trouble, and they're asking for $500 million loan that you know they're not going to be able to pay off. If they can't pay it off, then the United States government becomes the owner of Spirit Airlines. So, I mean, in a way, I guess I should approve as a socialist of de facto nationalizing of corporate assets. But I would hope that we could like seize a better airline than Spirit.
Yeah, I agree with you. If the business can't operate, then that's on the business. Like, that is...
Right. Look, isn't that the essence of capitalism, right?
It is. And us owning the business, it's not going to give us cheaper prices. So, yeah. I mean, kick rocks.
And also, I really don't think they're too big to fail. I mean, if these carriers go out of business... I mean, by the way, they're not really low cost, right? It's like basically the ticket price is low cost. But if you'd like to bring luggage, that's $100 each way. I mean, that's not an exaggeration.
No, that's not an exaggeration. That's how much it costs. They may say it's $150 each way. They can say, because what they try to do is basically cut services to cut costs.
Yeah, that's it.
We have a
question before we close out for today. Maybe Bluth Funk. Guys, regarding the accusers, do people care? Sometimes I wonder if the average man is just a poor Caligula, e.g. the abuses of the Catholic Church, Boy Scouts. Surely people knew. Well, some people knew, obviously.
I think people care. I mean, and the Catholic Church is a little bit different just because they're functioning around a particular ideology, in which case they want to defend the ideology despite the fact that these people are pedophiles. Yeah. But I think if you go to just regular people, they feel some kind of way about stuff. It's, you know, I think people are empathetic, especially at a distance, if that makes sense. Like, meaning they can see something and feel some kind of way about, like, hey, that's outrageous. Hey, that shouldn't happen, et cetera, especially if they're not in that context and they just think it's wrong. If I see somebody get murdered, I'm going to feel some way about the person that got murdered.
Let's close out with an ad because we have one. Let's see. Hold on. Okay, they can freeze your accounts, shut off your cards, lock you out of your own money overnight. Banks don't protect you, they control you. That's why real financial freedom starts with ownership. Introducing Rumble Wallet, a non-custodial wallet built for people who refuse to give up control. With Rumble Wallet, you don't just buy digital currency like Bitcoin and Tether. You can own Tether Gold, real gold on the blockchain through Tether Gold. You get direct ownership of physical gold bars, each one fully allocated, verifiable by serial number, purity, and weight. This isn't paper gold. This isn't an IOU. This is real gold. Without bank vaults, storage fees, or gatekeepers, you can buy, sell, or move it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even when traditional gold markets are closed. And if you want, Tether Gold can be redeemed for physical gold. That's power. And when you support creators on Rumble, you can tip them directly using Rumble Wallet. Peer-to-peer and outside the banking system, no permissions, no middlemen, no cancel button. This wallet is yours forever. JT, would you be so kind as to take us out?
I will indeed.
Thank you.
You guys are listening or watching the program wherever you are. We have we appreciate you watching this particular program, this show. My name is Jamal Thomas. I am joined with Ted Raw and Robbie below as the producer. You guys are fantastic. Great audience. And we will see you bright and early tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Stay tuned for Manila Chan with Ted Raw. You guys have a fantastic day. Be safe. Signing off.